Now for a fashion note about some of the hot items of the season. Short skirts, tight jeans with long boots, and short jackets for cold days. That may not sound exceptional or even very trendy, but this is the fashion forecast from Baghdad, where the climate for revealing women's wear has been heating up. Many Iraqi women say it's a sign of returning security and freedom. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports from Baghdad.
This is the shop of Ali Mohammed, a 25-year-old entrepreneur who boasts that his line is for the modern Iraqi woman, not what he deprecatingly calls classic designs for classic ladies. Most of his customers, Ali says, are young women, many of them college students. Ever since the 2003 invasion, the classic design for Baghdad ladies, at least on the street, has been hijab, the Islamic expression of modesty that requires a woman to cover her shape and her hair. Even if an Iraqi woman had a little black dress, it would have been covered by a big black abaya, the billowing garment that shrouds a woman from head to foot. At the height of Iraq's sectarian violence, being covered up was a matter of life and death. Ali says it was common to hear of women being kidnapped and killed for not wearing hijab, and his customers were scared. In fact, it's still the case that far more Baghdad women at least wear a headscarf on the streets rather than show their hair. But at social venues, the times are changing. This is the Baghdad Hunt Club, in what foreign correspondents never fail to describe as the trendy or upscale Mansour district. The occasion is the Miss Hunt Club pageant, and a big crowd is cheering on more than a dozen contestants, only one of whom is wearing a headscarf. Most of the others are wearing the sorts of clothing that Ali Mohammed sells in his shop, outfits in varying degrees of snugness and hemlines in the higher latitudes. Some are propped on stiletto heels that would topple a runway model in Milan. 18-year-old Samah Samir was eliminated before the final round, but she says the pageant was a good way to show her confidence. Her mother, who wears a headscarf, is seated nearby, beaming. Samah says she can't wear trendy clothes everywhere in Baghdad, but at social clubs like this, it's just the thing. She says it may take at least 5 years before Western clothes for women are common on city streets. The tiara goes to Yasemin Kanan, a high school senior who's wearing low-waisted jeans. Under the dryers at Rana Mohammed's hair salon, women read fashion magazines and discuss trends. The 25-year-old proprietor says she was forced to wear hijab for years because the danger from Islamist fanatics was just too great. But she says it's really not about fashion, but freedom. She says Iraqi women ought to be free to wear whatever they like. They should be free to choose hijab if they wish, or they ought to be able to express themselves with Western clothing. For the customers at Ali Mohammed's clothing store, the choice is clear. What to wear this season? Ali says it's absolutely not hijab. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Baghdad.
As the World Turns is about to stop turning, CBS has announced it will cancel the soap opera next year after more than 13,000 episodes. Actress Eileen Fulton joined the show's cast in 1960, and she joins us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You have been with this show half a century. How did you react to hearing that it was going to come to an end?
I'm very sad about it. I'm sad for the fans. We are family. Years ago, when I was doing a tour, A woman came up to me and she said, "I want to know why, when my mother was dying, you were the one she was concerned about and her family was gathered around, but your character was dying." And she asked the priest, "How is Lisa?" And he turned around and he said, "Where is there a Lisa here?" And they said, "No, no." "Oh, it's Mother's soap opera." She said, "Why was your name on my mother's lips as she died?" And I said, "Well, I came into her home every day. We were company for your mother."
Tell us a little bit about your character for listeners who might not be familiar with the program.
Well, when I started on the show in 1960, she was just supposed to be a sweet little girl next door. I had little cute lines to say or something, but I thought the worst thoughts, the worst, most obscene things. And it came across, and Erna Phillips, the writer, said, "Well, that little rascal can play a bitch." And so that's what I did.
So you were really the first mean girl in television soap operas, and people feel strongly about your character. I understand you even had to have bodyguards at one point.
Of course I did, and that's fun. They love to hate me. But you know how it really began was I was standing on the street corner in front of Lord & Taylor's, and this elegant woman came up to me, and she said, "Aren't you Lisa?" And I thought, "Oh, my first autograph." I said, "Yes, that's the character I play." And she said, "Well, I hate you." And she hit me. And that was the beginning. I thought, well, this is kind of scary. But at least it was a compliment to the acting.
Is it hard to be believable when your character has been married 8 times, widowed several times over, divorced again and again?
No, and let's correct that. I've been married 9 times.
Oh, pardon me.
That's okay.
Can you even recite Lisa's full name with all of the husbands
yes,
she's
I can.
Had? Oh, please do.
I hoped you would ask. Lisa Mellor Hughes, Eldridge Hughes, Shea Coleman, Almost Hadley, McCall, Mitchell Grimaldi, Chedwin.
That is impressive. How did the show change over the years that you've been with the program?
It's changed monstrously. When I started, it was a half-hour show, and it was live. That kept your weight down, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
I was terrified.
Were there any famous bloopers?
Sure. There was a time when I was to make Cherry's Jubilee.
A recipe that involves fire.
Yes, it does. And I had to start by making it in rehearsal. And I kept lighting it, and it wouldn't catch on fire.
Oh, no.
So finally, on air, they just poured, I don't know, kerosene or something in it, and it went, boom, up to the curtains above the set, caught the curtains on fire. And Walter Cronkite was in the next studio. He was testing for the noon news or something, and he said, "Studio on fire?" And they said, "Oh, it's just the soap opera next door."
Thank you so much.
It has been a pleasure.
Eileen Fulton is a longtime actor on As the World Turns. CBS says it will cancel the long-running soap opera next year.
Finally, I've been thinking a lot recently about two brown men whose bad behavior has been much in the news, Chris Brown and Tiger Woods. Woods, of course, is the uber-famous and hyper-talented golfer whose business has lately been in the street. It's come to light that he's been spending quality time with a number of ladies other than the one to whom he is married. This has happened in a particularly embarrassing way for somebody who seemed to cherish his privacy, a car accident in the early morning hours outside his house, which for some reason led to the unveiling of the identities of a number of women with whom he's been sexually involved. Woods says he is now taking a break from golf to focus on his family and, as we would say, to get his head right. And some of his sponsors are taking a break from him, although it shouldn't put too big of a dent in his wallet because he's believed to be the first athlete to hit the $1 billion mark in terms of earnings. And if you just heard the previous segment, then you know that Chris Brown is a pop star who was in the news because he beat up his girlfriend, a fellow pop singer named Rihanna, the night before the Grammy Awards last February. He has more or less accepted responsibility by taking a guilty plea and has agreed to undergo counseling, along with a series of ritual humiliations like being interviewed ad nauseum. And now he has a new album out, so he has a further need to seek redemption by trying to explain himself. Can I just tell you, I think it should be said right up front that we know nothing about the real lives, especially the real interior lives of celebrities, notwithstanding the attempts of their spinmeisters and the celebrity entertainment media mob built up around them to portray them as either the squeaky clean family men or club-hopping Casanovas. We really have no idea. But having said that, I think we have a particular need to try to unpack the reality around these two men, precisely because they are young black men. And young black men have been the blank canvas on which we have always projected our anxieties about relationships, sex, and race. Ever since the explicitly racist film Birth of a Nation to black people's own cultural creations like Bigger Thomas and the music videos produced by and for young black men have been portrayed as oversexed, violent, and lusting after that which they are not supposed to have, mainly white women and light-skinned women. So in addition to their celebrity, we have the added factor of the burden of history, which, like it or not, they are fighting against. It's probably one reason Tiger has worked so hard to de-racialize himself, from his made-up racial group of one to his efforts to remove himself from any conversation about the burdens and discrimination faced by other outsiders, like the women in his sport. A free society means you must also be free to love whom you will love. So I personally don't care who Tiger sleeps with, except to the degree that his behavior suggests a mania and a lack of intimacy that is depressing to contemplate. It suggests that he pursues women the way he plays golf, without regard to distraction, with the goal of sublimating feeling. He is the anti-stereotype, in a way. And Chris Brown, well, he makes me sad because, once again, a young brown man, like too many young brown men, has become another statistic, a captive of the criminal justice system, despite himself. I suspect that there is more to his story than he is letting on. People tend to do unto others what has been done to them, and I suspect that growing up in a household where there was abuse, as he did and as he has disclosed, has primed him in ways he doesn't even understand or cannot even talk about yet. I guess this is a long way of saying I feel for both these men, despite their bad behavior. It's not to excuse what either of them did, how they hurt people they supposedly loved. But it is to say that the feelings of young black men like them have rarely been our primary concern. That might be why they have learned to demonstrate so little feeling for others. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Our linguist Jeff Nunberg is always paying attention to how our language is changing. He's been thinking about which words and phrases from the past year and decade have caught on and which haven't.
It's list-making season again. Time magazine got out of the gate early with its list of the year's top buzzwords, along with lists of the 10 top albums, apologies, fashion faux pas, and viral videos, among others. They had a lot of lively catchphrases to choose from: sexting, wise Latina, and beer summit, not to mention all the labels for people with doubts about the president's birthplace, his plans to pull the plug on granny, and whether the 10th Amendment allows the federal government to provide health care at all. The teabaggers, the birthers, the deathers, the tenthers, it sounds less like a political movement than the bill for a thrash metal concert in Cleveland. But words from headlines tend to be short-lived. They get a moment in the sun, then fade as quickly as a tan line. Remember Daisy Cutter, Spider Hole, Bennifer? They're a lot like the category that Time calls top fleeting celebrities, the linguistic equivalents of Nadia Suleiman, Carrie Prejean, Stephanie Burkett, and the Salahis. See, you forgot already. The more interesting words usually catch on more slowly. For its word of the year, the Oxford American Dictionary chose unfriend, as in, I went online and unfriended her. It's not a bad choice to stand in for the rise of social networks. It works the same bizarro alterations on the structure of an ordinary word that the social sites do on the structure of ordinary personal relationships. Granted, it's been around for a few years, but then these cultural trends can take a while to spread across the social landscape. By the time you can get good arugula in Tulsa, it's already coming off the menus in Tribeca. As it happens, this is one of the years when the odometer goes around two places. And the members of the American Dialect Society, which originated the Word of the Year business 20 years ago, will also be selecting a Word of the Decade when they meet in Baltimore in early January. I got a list of the nominees from the lexicographer Grant Barrett of WordNik, who's been taking suggestions via email and tweet. I wasn't interested in trying to pick a winner. That will almost certainly come down to one of a handful of obvious candidates, like 9/11, terrorism, Google, or Green. But to me, the interesting exercise was to see what picture emerges when you try to take in a whole decade's worth of words in a single glance. I stopped writing these down when I got to about 200 of them. The list already seemed like a hopeless hodgepodge. Swine flu and Sudoku, terrorist fist jab and freedom fries, maverick and macaca. It reminded me of a TV commercial for one of those hits of the 70s compilation CDs, with a succession of songs by Gloria Gaynor, Neil Diamond, Kool and the Gang, and The Clash. What exactly did they have in common, other than that they all happened to be on the air in the same season? But there are patterns. Groups of words arrange themselves into miniature narratives. WMDs, cakewalk, shock and awe, mission accomplished, backdoor draft, hillbilly armor, stay the course, redeployment. That basically sums up the story in 10 words or less. Not surprisingly, for the decade that divided the country into red and blue, it was saturated with sexual and cultural ambivalence. It pronounced approvingly on metrosexual and moved queer into prime time. At the same time, politicians were raising the specter of man on dog, and adolescents were turning gay into a new synonym for lame or uncool. It gave us cougar and femocracy. It also revived stand by your man and created dad and daughter purity balls and the verb bitch slap. In the realm of techno prefixes, E and cyber were out and I was in, along with neuro, echo, bloggo, and of course, twa. Technology also brought us malware and the pop-under, insidious successor to the pop-up, not to mention the assorted ailments known as cell phone neck, BlackBerry thumb, Nintendo elbow, and Facebook fatigue. It was a good decade for the lexicon of snark, starting with snark itself. We were busy voting people off the island, throwing them under the bus, and generally not here to make friends. It was the era of LOL, WTF, and the new interjection meh, an expression of bored indifference that has acquired more than 400,000 enthusiastic Facebook fans. Like every decade, it was rich in euphemisms. Some brought new creativity to familiar topics, have a wide stance and hiking the Appalachian Trail for sexual embarrassments, negative equity and distressed assets for financial ones. Others broke new ground. What was most disturbing about enhanced interrogation techniques and extraordinary rendition wasn't that they were indirect. It was that we were actually having those discussions at all. We've come a long way since the 1990s in its blissful ignorance of zombie banks and ninja loans, dirty bombs and IEDs, lolcats and bromances. But it's telling to recall some of the phrases that didn't catch on. We stopped saying, if you do that, the terrorist will win. In fact, we stopped talking about the terrorist, period. We didn't abandon country for homeland. We bailed on evildoers, and the coalition of the willing bailed on us. And we wound up giving the cheese-eating surrender monkeys their own chef shows on Bravo. It's a different language we speak now, but maybe not as much as we thought it might be.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.